Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On August 1st, Mexican photojournalist Ruben Espinosa, human rights activist Nadia Vera, her two roommates and a housekeeper were found dead in an apartment in Mexico City. The killing sent yet another shockwave through the journalist and activist communities in Mexico because Espinosa had gone into exile from the Gulf state of Veracruz, where his life was in danger. He is the first journalist to be killed in exile in Mexico City. 11 journalists have been killed in Veracruz since 2010, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joining us to talk about the state of journalism in Mexico and coverage of the killing of Espinosa and the four women is Alfredo Corchado, Mexico City Bureau Chief with the Dallas Morning News and author of the book Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. On July 28th, Alfredo testified before a House subcommittee on the Western Hemisphere for a hearing about press freedoms in the Americas. And Alfredo joins us from Dallas. Hi, Alfredo. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm actually on the border of El Paso, Ciudad Juarez today.
Oh, okay. Thank you. You're on the border today. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And as expected, presidential hopefuls were asked about immigration at last night's first GOP debate. Donald Trump said we need to build a wall to deal with, quote, the bad ones. Marco Rubio called for an E-Verify system and an entry-exit tracking system. But there were no questions about the for-profit immigration detention centers, the horrific treatment of the people who are behind bars, or the H-2 visa holders who were doing work in the U.S. and who are often exploited and abused by their U.S. employers. Jessica Garrison and her colleague Ken Bessinger conducted an in-depth investigation for BuzzFeed about the H-2 visa program, which invites foreign workers to do some of the most menial labor in the United States. They report that the program leaves these workers at the mercy of their American employers. Thousands of these workers have been abused, deprived of pay, imprisoned, starved, beaten, raped, and threatened with deportation if they complain. More than 150,000 H-2 visas were issued last year. That is a 50% increase over just 5 years. 2 weeks after the investigation revealed widespread abuse, members of Congress are now calling for reform. Jessica Garrison is a senior investigative editor for BuzzFeed News. She was previously a reporter with the LA Times, and she joins me in studio. Hi, Jessica. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We are also joined by Roque Planas, a reporter with the Huffington Post's Latino Voices page. Roque has been doing extensive reporting about immigrants being held in ICE family detention centers. These are for-profit private detention centers. Last month, a federal judge said the Obama administration's detention policy is illegal and should be discontinued. Roque Planas reports that women locked up with their children at these detention centers in Texas have been repeatedly subjected to medical neglect. Medical staff routinely tell women and their kids at a privately run facility in South Texas to drink more water when they show up with symptoms including broken bones, severe weight loss, and fainting spells. Hi, Roque. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have all of you. So as we always do on our media roundtable on Your Call, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Roque Planas with the Huffington Post's Latino Voices page, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I think it actually came out last week or the week before, but there was this piece in The New Yorker by John Lee Anderson about this fellow Hugo Cancio who sort of set himself up to be sort of Cuban-American broker who works with people in the Cuban government and Americans who are trying to get involved in what's going on in Cuba. But it was cool because it's sort of, my family's from Cuba, and I think a lot of the ways that Cuba gets presented is sort of, in this sort of static, like Cuba coming out of, trapped in communism sort of thing. But I thought he did a good job in showing, how it is that Cuba is actually really changing, like how there's these pockets of wealth that are popping up, how there are these, it's becoming a society that a lot of people who used to know Cuba wouldn't recognize. So it was just something that I thought was an interesting take on something that everybody's talking about right now, but done in a way where you could actually, sort of see it more on Cuba's terms.
Do you think that we'll see more of that reporting in the coming months?
I don't know. I think now that all the announcements are made in the embassy flags are gone up, I think there's going to be sort of flagging interest in Cuba until something big happens with the embargo.
Right. Okay, so kudos to John Lee Anderson with The New Yorker. Thank you for that one. That is Roque Planas. He's a reporter with the Huffington Post Latino Voices page. And what about you, Jessica? Jessica Garrison is a senior investigative editor for BuzzFeed. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to plug two things. I'm going to plug a story that actually came out maybe a couple weeks ago by one of my colleagues at BuzzFeed, Asmat Khan, who wrote a story about the school building effort in Afghanistan by the U.S. government, and basically went all over Afghanistan and discovered that many of the schools that the U.S. government said it built have fallen into disrepair or, and are actually educating only boys and not girls. So I want to give a shout out to that, which I thought was amazing.
And can I just ask you, why educating only boys? Who's making that decision?
I think that's a really complicated question. I think that the larger finding of the piece was that many of the schools that were built have just fallen into disrepair. Because they're in areas where they cannot be maintained, or because corruption or other complicated issues have made the maintenance of them difficult. She also identified many cases where there are teachers on the books, but maybe not in the classroom. And then she went to a few places where there just were not girls. So it's a really interesting story, because obviously education was something that was touted as a success of that very long and very difficult war. So I thought that was fantastic. And then on a personal note, I don't know who wrote these, but I just want to give a shout out to the expose of overuse of air conditioning in offices. You've seen some in the New York Times and the Washington Post that basically find that thermostats are set for men, not women. And as someone who spent a lot of time in the summer huddled in a blanket with fingerless gloves, I say, yay for that little bit of investigative reporting.
Well, how do they determine what men like in terms of air conditioning and what women like?
It was not a deeply scientific study. I think they basically wandered around in the sun. But it's gotten a lot of attention, and I think it's kind of delightful.
Well, okay, so kudos. I just found this piece. Pam Bellick at the New York Times wrote a piece, Office Air Conditioning Overuse Promotes Global Warming and Sex Discrimination.
There you go. Nice. Hard-hitting reporting.
Really good headline. And then this sounds like a great piece. Asmat Khan wrote about U.S. government-funded schools in Afghanistan that have fallen into disarray, and they're educating boys and not girls. That sounds like a really good piece. Thank you for that. That is Jessica Garrison, senior investigative editor with BuzzFeed. And what about you, Alfredo? Alfredo Cochardo is Mexico City bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought what was done well was that following the killing of former journalist Rubén Espinosa, there's been so much fear among the journalism community in Mexico, but yet so many publications, Sin Embargo, Animal Político, many of them online, really came out and asked the tough questions and have kept pressing amid the clout that shrouds the killing of Espinosa. In particular, it's a kudos to Marcela Turati, an investigative journalist in Mexico City, works for Proceso magazine. She's been very, very dogged, very passionate about bringing to light the threats that Espinosa received from the governor of the state of Veracruz. And I talked to her earlier in the week. She says, yes, there's a lot of scare reporters, a lot of scare journalists that are wondering, what does this mean for Mexico City now? What does this mean for people who are trying to find exile? And yet, there they are. They're on the front lines. They're reporting, knowing that the consequences could be deadly.
I missed his last name.
Marcela Turati.
Turati. Okay. Thank you for that. And he works with Profer?
She works for a publication called Proceso, but also does work for other publications throughout Mexico.
Okay, thank you. That is Alfredo Corchado. He is Mexico City bureau chief with the Dallas Morning News, talking about the brave journalists in Mexico who are writing about the kill and speaking out about the killing of photojournalist Rubén Espinosa. And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. Now, Alfredo, you testified before a House subcommittee on July 28th, And you said, quote, I live in, work in, call home a country where every 26 hours a reporter is attacked, most of them by either the government or criminal gangs. Too many journalists in my homeland of Mexico have paid the ultimate price. And you said, today I hope to honor their memory. Mexico is one of the most dangerous places in the world for journalists. Every 26 hours a reporter is attacked. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, this is according to Articulo 19, which is an NGO in Mexico City based to help protect journalists. They and Periodistas de a Pie, another NGO, have tabulated the numbers in the last few months, and that's the figure they came up with, was that every 26 hours we hear of a reporter being harassed, being attacked, being threatened with not reporting certain things or photographs. And they came out with that comes out to every 26 hours a reporter is attacked or harassed or threatened.
So talk a little bit about just what it is what it's like every day in Mexico for journalists, because you also pointed out at the hearing that you were born in Mexico and grew up in the United States. So you're a binational citizen. You have a U.S. passport. And you say that you believe that being American is the reason you report on stories that many of your colleagues do not live long enough to tell.
You know, the impunity rate in Mexico is so high. It's over 90% of the homicides against journalists or journalists who are killed are cases that are never solved. Most of them are faceless victims. I want to believe, and there's obviously debate among some of my closest colleagues, some of my closest friends, I want to believe that if something was to happen to me or an American journalist or a foreign correspondent, that there would be an outcry, that there would be a government asking for answers, that there would be a society demanding to know what happened and try to hold someone accountable, so hold someone responsible for that killing. That doesn't happen in Mexico. Unfortunately, you have colleagues who are killed, who are threatened in Mexico alone. And this is different from agencies. The Committee to Protect Journalists says that over the last 10 years or so, there's been more than 50 journalists killed. Freedom House puts the number at more than 120. It depends on the criteria that they use. But of those numbers, the vast majority of these cases remain unsolved. Mm. And so as a Mexican-born journalist but with a U.S. credential, I mean, whenever I cover places that are deemed dangerous, some of the regions, I always try to make sure that I have a U.S. passport to show, or that I have a credential that shows that I work for an international agency, that will remind people that, you know, something was to happen, that it could affect their business. I mean, we're not talking about a religious war or a political. This is purely economics. It's a $30 to $40 billion drug industry. And I want to believe that that will have an impact. If it disrupts the trade, it could disrupt the bottom line.
Hmm. And so you say that because you're an American citizen, the cartels fear the wrath of the U.S. government.
Yes, that's something that's been told to me. That's something that I continue to believe. Hmm.
Tell us a little bit about Mexican photojournalist Ruben Espinosa. He was very young. He was just 31 years old, and he was killed on August 1st.
Well, he was actually killed on last Friday. I think it was the 31st. He was someone, I mean, what's interesting about Ruben Espinosa is that he was not covering organized crime. He was covering more the social issues in Mexico, whether the students disappear in the Ayotzinapa massacre or the killing of some of his colleagues. He was much more interested in social issues. There's been different opinions about, you know, what could have led to this. We still don't know. There's been one person arrested. The authorities now claim that robbery could have been the motive, which is something they said immediately after Ruben Espinosa was killed. It's not surprising that you would try to come to a swift judgment. I mean, there's so much of an international outcry that there's a lot of pressure on the authorities to say something. I think it'll be very difficult to try to really convince the public at large as to what happened. But Ruben was very, very much involved in social issues in Veracruz, had taken lots of pictures of authorities who were allegedly beating some of the protesters at one place. another allegation or story is that he took unflattering portraits of the governor of Veracruz, and those two led to authorities telling Ruben, you know, watch yourself. You're getting too ahead of yourself, or you're getting a little too comfortable, too confident. After the last incident on July 9th, he decided to leave Veracruz and fled to Mexico City.
And talk about the significance of his death in Mexico City, because he had gone into exile from Veracruz where his life was in danger. And a lot of people are quoted in stories saying that they were shocked that he was killed in Mexico City.
Mexico City for the longest time has been considered a safe haven, especially for journalists. I mean, we haven't seen a high-profile journalist killed since 1984, I think mm-hmm. it was, with Manuel Mendia. And so in the last few years, with regions of Mexico falling to cartels or organized crime, regions of Mexico that are now considered regions of silence, where reporters say nothing, see nothing, Mexico City was considered to be the place where people could flee to and report from. It was considered safe, not just for Mexican journalists, but I think the journalism community as well. With this happening, I mean, I think I would be remiss if I didn't say that I think a lot of journalists, whether Mexican or American or just foreign, are somewhat on edge. I mean, we're trying to figure out what happened and whether someone's going to actually pay the price and we can go back to feeling more comfortable. I mean, that's something that we don't know yet.
Alfredo Corchado is Mexico City Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News and author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Jessica Garrison is Senior Investigative Editor for BuzzFeed. And Roque Planas is a reporter with the Huffington Post's Latino Voices page. And today it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. What struck you in the media this week? Did you hear about the killing of Mexican photojournalist Ruben Espinosa? Also, human rights activist Nadia Vera, her two roommates, and also a housekeeper were found dead in an apartment in Mexico City. If you'd like to join us to talk about coverage of what it is like for journalists in Mexico and coverage also of immigration issues, the drug war gets so much attention. And like we saw in last night's debate, it's all about building a wall, e-verify systems, e-tracking. What can we do to keep the, quote, illegals out? I mean, that's pretty much the extent of the conversation we're hearing so far in the Republican debate with these presidents. But you don't hear about the human side of immigration. So where are you seeing that kind of reporting? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Roque Planas, because the drug war, and now that we're in this presidential cycle, we're hearing a lot about immigration, but we don't hear much about the human side or what it is like to be a journalist in Mexico. What are your thoughts about the reporting on these issues? Have you seen much about Ruben Espinosa, and what are your thoughts on it?
I've seen some. It's not a case that I have covered myself, but I mean, I think that the thing that, for me, looking afar at it, that I think really needs to be put a lot of attention is that what we learned with the case with the Ayotzinapa students is that it's very difficult to trust what the government is saying, because subsequent reporting by people like Marcelo Turati, like people like Anabel Hernandez and so forth, have shown that there's a lot of inconsistencies with what the government has been saying about that investigation, and it is possible that they've been torturing suspects, which would undermine the prosecution.
And Jessica, what are your thoughts? Have you been following this case?
I followed it a little bit. I mean, I think every journalist has followed it a little bit. I don't think I have much to add, except that obviously nobody should be killed for doing their job, no matter what their job is. And I think that I'm struck, as I think a lot of us are, by the courage of the people who are pursuing this work in Mexico. And so, you know, can I jump in with a question?
Please.
Can you talk for you who are in Mexico City? I mean, how much does fear kind of permeate how people are doing their jobs and how they go about doing their jobs and how they choose what stories to cover and how they go about covering them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think for the longest time, I mean, we felt safe in Mexico City. But I think among the foreign correspondent community, I mean, there's still a sense of, you know, we are much more protective, and with the dangers that we face really pale in comparison to what our colleagues in Mexico face. But again, I think that that bubble, that safe haven, has been broken. And we're all eagerly awaiting to see if something really comes out of the investigation. Again, there's been so many inconsistencies in the past that you come up with some kind of decision, and then you spend years really questioning that investigation. I think for the Johnson community, or for anyone who really wants to move ahead from this one, you know, there has to be some kind of closure. I mean, there has to be some kind of justice.
Do you think this could be a turning point, Alfredo, since it happened in Mexico City?
Absolutely. There have been many. I mean, there's more than 30 journalists in Mexico who have been seeking protection, who are in self-imposed exile. Many of them are now questioning whether that's really a good idea, whether Mexico City is really that safe. It's definitely a turning point. I mean, it's a new low for Mexico, and it's diminishing standards.
And Roque, do you have any questions for Alfredo before we let him go?
No, I think I'm hearing it loud and clear. It's just, you know, but maybe just to say, you know, it's inspiring to see all y'all continue to do what you're doing, even in the face of these kind of threats. And I think that it's something that we in the media here in the United States should really be doing, is elevating the work of our colleagues in Mexico, because that is one way that we can help to keep them safe.
I just want to add that, I mean, Roque brings up really a critical point. And when you talk to colleagues in Mexico, that's really what they will say, that this has to be something that goes beyond Mexico. I mean, it has to be an international outcry. And the more journalists, the more colleagues you have who are in solidarity with the Mexican colleagues, I think that's really when you're going to start seeing changes in Mexico, when you have much more of an international pressure on the current government. Hmm.
And Alfredo, what are you working on right now?
Working on several stories. It's political season, and so one of the stories that I'm working on is on the Mexico bashing. You know, does it help states like California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas? I mean, how far can you take this, the whole Mexico bashing part? Hmm. It was interesting last night just watching Donald Trump. I kept thinking, okay, how many times is he going to dump on Mexico? It wasn't as many as I thought, but I still find it kind of interesting.
Right, because a lot of people, when he called Mexicans rapists at first, people thought, is he going to use that same language?
Rapists and murderers.
Right. He basically said he wants to build a wall, and he kind of left it at that. Although he did say we have to deal with the, quote, bad ones that the Mexican government sent to the United States.
Well, I'm at the University of Texas, El Paso, and right across you can see Ciudad Juarez, and you can see that the wall is there. I don't know how much higher they want to go.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alfredo. We'd love to
My
have
pleasure.
You back. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico City Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News and author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. And you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Coming up, we will talk about coverage of immigrants in for-profit detention centers in the United States. We will also talk about H-2 visa holders who are doing work in the United States and are often exploited and abused by U.S. employers. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
On Local Public Radio, Your Call with Rosa Aguilar. If you have a perspective that we have not yet shared in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join our conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. You can also send your question via email if you prefer. Address it to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Reveal here on Local Public Radio. And then at noon, it's the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation about conservation funding and the growing call to outlaw big game hunting. The recent killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe has sparked a debate over trophy hunting and illegal poaching. There are 34,000 lions in Africa. 3 decades ago, there were at least 68,000. So why are lion populations declining? Would an end to trophy hunting actually help wildlife conservation? And what about funding? What is the most effective way to fund conservation? That's on Monday. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We are talking about coverage of the treatment of immigrants in the United States. We're going to talk about immigrants in detention centers in the U.S., and then we'll talk about H-2 visa holders. These are people who come from Central, South America, Mexico, who do temporary work in the U.S., and who are often abused and exploited by their employers. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What grabbed your attention in the news this week, and what do you think about coverage of immigration? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jessica Garrison is senior investigative editor for BuzzFeed. She was previously a reporter at the LA Times. Roque Planas is a reporter with the Huffington Post's Latino Voices page. And Roque, you have been doing extensive coverage about immigrants being held in ICE family detention centers. These are privatized centers. Last month, a federal judge said the Obama administration's detention policy is illegal and should be discontinued. Talk about the significance of that, of the judge saying that the policy is illegal.
Well, it's potentially very significant. It could overturn family detention as we know it. And, I mean, for now, right? But it's being contested. The government just filed a response to the judge's order last night, very late, around midnight California time, in which they're basically saying that they need to be allowed to continue to detain mothers with their children in order to process them more efficiently and because it deters future migrants from traveling together. Now, but like just for a little bit of the context, family detention was used very sparingly after about 2009. The Obama administration really stepped back because it was getting protested quite heavily in Texas. And then when they shut down that last sort of big family detention center, they maintained a small one in Pennsylvania. But they brought it back last year after we had the the so-called surge of unaccompanied minors and family units, were basically children crossing with their mothers. There was about 68,000 unaccompanied minors who came in fiscal year 2014 and a similar number of family units traveling together. So what you had the Obama administration's response was to create an entirely new detention center at Dilley, which is run as a private sort of for-profit enterprise by Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest prison contractor, and then to expand capacity at Carnes. Both of these are in South Texas. So basically, what you're seeing is this sort of massive use of family detention that a lot of people think is very inhumane, because the vast majority of the women and children that are being locked up in there have credible asylum claims.
So they have credible asylum claims, and yet they say that, you've reported on this, women are being locked up with their kids. Medical staff routinely tell them to drink water when they show up with horrible symptoms like broken bones, severe weight loss, and fainting spells.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of really horrific stories. You know, and there's a lot of stories that I think, like, lawyers and activists have picked up on, because they really highlight, you know, there's a lot of shock value. Like, people, a woman who had been raped and beaten by a gang that had abducted her and then showed up and had broken fingers in her hands, right? And then they told her to drink more water instead of giving her medical treatment and stuff like that. And I think, like, these kind of cases, they really highlight, you know, I mean, there's a lot of shock value in them because they are so ugly. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, that's bad, and we should be looking at that and highlighting that, right? But at the same time, I think that there's like a subtext, which is that these people are, for the you know, in most cases, right, in the large majority of cases, are fleeing very widespread violence, really just sort of a breakdown of state to the point where you have organized crime that's really, really penetrated people's lives, you know, people that are being pressed into gang, people that fear for the lives of their children. And one of the things that psychologists are finding when they evaluate people have crossed recently is this part of wave, there's this wave of migration from Central America, is that the mothers and the children are showing that they have signs of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, some of these cases are just, you know, kind of extremely egregious, and the way that they've been handled by the centers is very questionable. But I think one thing that really needs to be highlighted is that the experience is sort of uniform across the board. You see a lot of people that have just have experienced very serious trauma in the country. They've experienced very serious trauma migrating by land. They've experienced further trauma in the family detention centers, and they have the even greater weight of being sometimes allegedly threatened that their children will be separated from them if they don't comply with what guards are telling them to do, and just the fear that their children are being subjected to this kind of treatment, that their children are basically in jail. In one case that I do want to highlight that we wrote about in the Huffington Post, a young mother had traveled to the United States from Honduras fleeing threats from a gang. The gang had threatened this woman for a long time, and so they had threatened her for a long time, but then they eventually threatened to kill her child, and that's when she made the decision to come to the United States. They came here, and the child became ill and started vomiting blood. And I talked to a doctor and asked, why would a child vomit blood? And they said, stress ulcers.
Mm.
Right? So, I mean, that's just to give you an idea of the kind of experience that people are being subjected to in family detention. I think there's a sort of perception on the part of the general population in this country, right, of the reading public, that these are migrants like any others. And they're really not. This is a group of people that are completely traumatized.
Right. And as you said, it's important to provide the entire journey, right? So what happened in the home country, crossing the border, and then you get to the United States. And Jessica, you did the same thing in your explosive investigation, The New American Slavery, Invited to the U.S., Foreign Workers Find a Nightmare. So these are not undocumented workers. These are legal workers who are working under this H-2 visa program. They're working at shrimp farms, in hotels. You report that in many cases, under this program, it leaves them at the mercy of their employers. Thousands of these workers have been abused, deprived of their pay, imprisoned, starved, beaten, raped, and threatened. And talk a little bit about, you know, when you first sit down to do something like this, what goes through your mind when you think about the importance of telling the whole story, why they left their home country, what it took to get here, and then what they found once they got here?
I mean, I think that's a really good point, right? Like, you can't, and that was something that in this story we came back to again and again and again, because you have people who, you know, and I should say right at the outset, this is a pretty big program, and there are lots of employers in this program who follow the rules perfectly. So it's not, you know, 100% bad. But we did find that there are extensive abuses. And one of the things we found that surprised us is that even people who came here and were not paid what they were supposed to be paid, and who, you know, would talk sort of casually about, you know, oh yeah, when I was there, I wasn't allowed to leave except, you know, for a few hours on Sunday. They would just sort of drop that in conversation as if it was totally normal not to be allowed to leave your place of work except for, you know, a few hours on Sunday. And yet they were desperate to go back. And the reason they were desperate to go back, you know, I mean, obviously people who were incredibly exploited, not paid, beaten, they were not desperate to go back. But people who were sort of maybe paid a little bit less than they were supposed to have been, or who felt that they were not treated with very much respect by their employer, were still desperate to return. And the reason they were desperate to return is that they're twofold. Number one, there just isn't work in a lot of these places where they're from. And number two, a lot of the workers told us, we want to do this right. We want to follow the rules. We want to come legally. We don't want to pay a coyote and come across the border and never be able to go home and see our kids. We like this program because we can come for 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 months, and then we can go home. And we can, you know, maybe we have to miss our kid's birthday every year, but we can be there and see, you know, them for a few months of the year. And so I think that, you know, there is always a push-pull factor in all of these cases. And the the pull is the opportunity to make work, and the push is that they're just, you know, in a lot of these places, the economy is devastated. Mm.
Tell us about the women who work at the shrimp farms in Louisiana.
So, I mean, you know, there are lots all, if you drive as myself and my colleague did through rural Louisiana, you will see that there, you know, it's shrimp and it's crawfish and it's crab. And, you know, these tend to be pretty small operations. They tend to be kind of owned by kind of Cajun folk who have been working in shrimp, you know, for decades, and they need workers for a few months of the year. When the crawfish or the shrimp come in, that shrimp needs to be peeled so that it can be processed. And so they will, and that industry has become very reliant on the H2 program. And again, want to stress, a lot of these employers treat their workers well. They have the same workers year after year. They know them. You know, I was in an operation in Louisiana where it was a worker's birthday, and they had a cake and they had balloons. And so, you know, it's, I want to be clear that it's not all bad, but, you know, I think there are some operations where workers come and feel like they really are not getting the deal that they signed up for.
And in this case, sometimes these women are sexually harassed, sexually abused. They are made to do things that, like, lift up their tops, for example, when the boss walks into the room.
I mean, just to be clear, those are allegations. They have not been adjudicated in a court of law. But yes, there was a case we looked at where some women came to a crawfish operation in a town kind of north of Lafayette, Louisiana. And they, you know, this case was interesting because the women claimed, and again, unproven, but they did make a claim that they were repeatedly sexually harassed. And then one thing that we do know for sure is that when they tried to leave the farm and go on a date, the local police pulled them over, detained them, and then returned them to their place of work. And that's sort of interesting because we actually have a police report saying, you know, the boss asked for me to, those are my workers, and he asked me to detain them and scare them a little bit. And so, you know, that sort of goes to something else that a lot of workers experience, which is that they are absolutely terrified, even though they're here legally, of being deported, and they're absolutely terrified of local authorities.
You report that more than 100,000 people come from Mexico, Guatemala, the Philippines, South Africa. They come to the United States on this H-2 visa to clean rooms at luxury resorts and national parks, to pick fruit, cut lawns, manicure golf courses, set up carnival rides, trim and plant trees, herd sheep, or peel crawfish. Why have these numbers exploded? 150,000 issued last year. This is a 50% increase over 5 years. Who's making these decisions?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. I think that, you know, most small businesses that rely on these workers say that they would like, they have complaint, you know, they complain that the process is incredibly bureaucratic, which I think it is, and that it's very difficult to get the number of workers that they would like to get. And I think that there are a lot of people who would like to see this program expand because they would like to see more workers coming in, you know, for seasonal work. So as to why these numbers have expanded, I mean, I think there has been consistent pressure from people who would like to see it expand.
You reviewed more than a dozen investigations by the Department of Justice. This is the arm of the government that's supposed to ensure employers treat guest workers in accordance with the law. And you report that in most cases, inspectors interviewed few, if any, workers, showed up at workplaces only with advance warning, and accepted at face value the employer's version of the events.
So I think that's the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. And I think, you know, the Department of Labor will be the first to tell you that they don't have the staff that they need to really do this kind of enforcement. I think they noted that they have 1,000 wage and hour investigators for all 135 million American workers. And, you know, in their defense, trying to get to the bottom of what's happening with some of these workers is very difficult. They almost... You know, I don't think we ever encountered I'm sure there are H2 workers that speak English, but not very many. They tend to speak Spanish. They tend to speak no English. I don't know what percentage of the Department of Labor's investigation staff speak Spanish, but I don't think it's 100. So talking to the workers was difficult. They would need a translator. They would need to know, you know, and also in many of these cases, the workers are itinerant. You know, in a lot of these industries, for example, forestry, which is heavily reliant on H2 workers, they are moving from place to place to place to place every few days, every few weeks. So for the Department of Labor to find them, they kind of do have to give them advance warning because they have to be like, what state are you in? Okay, we're going to come on Thursday. Don't leave. But we also talked to lots of workers who were told by their employer, the Department of Labor is coming on Thursday. You better not tell them the truth, because if you do, we'll blacklist you and you can't come back next year. So I think, you know, the workers themselves often kind of participate in covering up the abuses because they are afraid.
What is it like to get access for both of you? Roque, when you try to talk to people who are in detention centers in South Texas, for example, what is that process like?
Well, basically, the way that it works is that the way that we've done it is to go through their lawyers so that when they go to there's a sort of legal trailer where they'll, you know, speak to their clients. And then at that point, you can talk to them on the cell phone. You can have, you know, just a conversation with them. It's a little bit harder if you were to go through regular channels. And so it's actually been one of the things that's made that kind of reporting a whole lot easier. In the case of family detention, I mean, it's you know, going to go interview people in detention isn't always easy.
And what about you, Jessica? What was it like for you to try to gain access to these workers who say they're being abused by U.S. employers?
I mean, it was challenging. You know, one of the things we did is we actually went to Sinaloa in Mexico because people were much more comfortable talking on that side of the border than on this side of the border. We also kind of wandered around Louisiana, talking to people not at the workplace, but outside the workplace. And we connected to lawyers who helped us connect with their clients. And, you know, we found that some people were really willing to talk and some people were obviously terrified to talk. And we also had cases where we talked to workers and we felt that maybe they were not being 100% forthright with us about their working conditions.
We hear a lot about H-1B visas. Mm-hmm. We rarely hear about H-2 visas.
You rarely do.
Right. And so how did you even come across this story?
Well, that's a good question. I came across it because I was working, I was sort of generally interested in something entirely different having to do with forestry. And somebody out in the world who knew that I was interested in this stumbled across a lawsuit that had been filed against a small timber company that where the workers alleged that they had been basically held at gunpoint in the forests about 100 miles from here in Northern California, forced to drink from a stream, and in kind of a crazy 19th century touch, they were forced to pay huge amounts of money for boots that had been like held together with nails. So I read this lawsuit kind of slack-jawed, and I had never heard of the program. And then when I finished reading the lawsuit, I turned to my colleague, Ken Bensinger, who worked on the story with me, and said, have you ever heard of this program? And he said, no, I've never heard of this program. And we both just kind of got very interested at that point.
And so what kind of work are they doing in the forest in Northern California?
They are thinning and planting trees, which is something that happens in a lot of national forests. And in fact, the federal government, you know, indirectly employs a lot of H-2 workers because they award federal contracts for tree planting and tree thinning, which is done largely, although, of course, not entirely, by workers on H-2 visas.
And so the argument behind this is that Americans won't take these jobs, and that's why they need to increase the number of H-2 visas?
I mean, I think employers will tell you we cannot find Americans willing to do this work. You know, and to some extent, that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, the counter to that, which a lot of people make, is, well, maybe you should pay a little bit more and then you will be able to find Americans to do that work. But, you know, a lot of this work is very difficult. It's incredibly physically exhausting. It is often itinerant. So you're going from place to place to place, and it is temporary. So, you know, they argue that it is very difficult to find people willing to work unbelievably hard for 4 months of the year and then not the other 12.
You know, talking to both of you, I mean, you're putting a human face on immigration, which when you follow the horse race of the presidential election, that it rarely happens. And so, Roque, what can be done to try to get these kinds of stories into the national conversation? I mean, rather than talk about walls last night, you know, what if there would have been a question about the treatment of people behind bars or the, you know, these H-2 visa workers who are completely exhausted, underpaid, in some cases sexually abused? I mean, how do you see that playing out in the next year and a half?
I don't know. I mean, I know that there's certainly some candidates who are trying to sort of make that a bigger issue, like on the Democratic side. Like, I know O'Malley in particular has made quite a big issue of immigration. I mean, I wish I knew more than just writing the stories and pushing them out for my company, how to get people to pay attention more. Because I think that we are kind of really trapped in this notion that immigration and illegal immigration and what to do with the 11 million people here is really trapped in this cycle of thinking, you know, about the people as the problem rather than trying to understand where it is that they're coming from. You know, certainly if you want to take it further back, which is one of the stories that I'm working on right now, and look at, you know, sort of the crises that precede this and the role that the United States had in precipitating a lot of the migration that's coming from Central America. You know what I mean?
Right.
It would presumably make people a little bit more sympathetic, but, you know, I mean, it's one of the big challenges that I think that we have, you know, that our political system right now is sort of geared toward really superficial analysis of things. I mean, the fact that Trump, for example, is playing so well in the Republican field and you know, and is becoming very popular, I think has something to do with the fact that he's more of an entertainer than he is a political thinker, right? And can get away with saying very simplistic things that resonate with a big part of the public. And, you know, that's a shame. I don't know exactly how you fix that, because a lot of that revolves around culture and the culture of television news and how information is disseminated in the country.
Right. And Jessica, what are your thoughts? I mean, as a former reporter with the LA Times before the show, you said that you were so happy that 350,000 people so far have read your investigation, which is a big number for you coming from the LA Times to BuzzFeed. It might not be a huge number for other stories on BuzzFeed, but people are clearly interested in this issue. So what are your thoughts about how to get the human story into this larger conversation about immigration?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, thankfully, I'm not a political reporter, so I'm not really an expert on how to, you know, expound upon, you know, the political sphere. But I actually am struck by how much the human story of immigration is told by so many media outlets. And I think that, you know, it is true that the human story of immigration doesn't figure in political sound bites, but it's also true that the full story of a lot of things don't figure in political sound bites. So I don't know if it's a feature of, you know, immigration per se, or just a feature of our political debate. I do think people are doing incredible work in a lot of different ways. And, you know, I think just a shout out to the LA Times, where I used to work, their immigration stories tend to be incredible and in depth and fantastic. And so I think a lot of outlets are doing this work, and I think that's great.
And just 2 weeks after your piece came out about H-2 workers who say they're being abused and exploited by their U.S. employers, members of Congress, actually Arizona Democrat Raul Grevalia, came out and said he's going to introduce legislation to increase oversight and accountability of the H-2 guest worker visa program.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of people who are concerned about this program and have been for a long time, and would like to see an increase in oversight and an increase in protections. I think, as we all know, introducing legislation in Congress and getting that legislation passed are two separate issues.
Right. So obviously they're starting something, and who knows if anything will come of it. But in the meantime, the program continues to grow.
In the meantime, the program continues.
And Roque, with the prisons, you said that the Obama administration just last night, after a judge said that the Obama administration's detention center is illegal and should be continued. The Obama administration came out last night and defended the program. So what's next on that?
Well, so the next step then is that the lawyers are going to write their response to the response, and the judge is going to decide which way she's going to go. And if she were to uphold the ruling that she initially said and start ordering them to clear out the family detention centers, then the United States government would presumably appeal, because they seem very committed to maintaining this system despite all the criticisms and despite the litigation.
And do we know how many families are actually being detained? Because there's a number of numbers are thrown out there based on, depending on where you read. So we had 68,000 moms traveling with their kids into the U.S. last year, but so many reports have different numbers. How many are currently being detained? Do you know?
In those two centers, we did have the numbers in the piece this morning. I think it was a little bit over 1,000, but a lot are being released. Some have been deported. Others have been moved. There was a chickenpox outbreak. So there's a lot of things that are happening that can, you know, the number that's being held there individually at any given moment, it won't necessarily reflect the total number of people that came in a year.
Right. And these are private facilities, right? They're owned by private corporations?
Yeah. These are private. The Dilley's run by the Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest private prison contractor and the second largest GEO Group, runs the second one. And then, you know, GEO Group is also the one who's making the ankle monitors that is being used as the alternative. So they make money when people goes in, they make money when people goes out too.
Roque Planas is a reporter with the Huffington Post Latino Voices page. You can find his reporting, extensive reporting, about families being held in ICE detention centers. Jessica Garrison is a senior investigative editor with BuzzFeed, and you can find her piece, The New American Slavery, Invited to the U.S., Foreign Workers Find a Nightmare, at yourcallradio.org. Roque and Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about conservation funding and the growing international call to outlaw big game hunting. The recent killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe has sparked a worldwide debate over trophy hunting and illegal poaching. There are 34,000 lions in Africa. Three decades ago, there were at least 68,000. So why are lions declining? Would an end to trophy hunting help wildlife conservation? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Raz is on as senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, one of history's great blues men, B.B. King, died this past May. We'll honor his life and legacy by devoting an entire show this week to a rebroadcast of our PBS television interview with the legendary guitarist. On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up in an hour at 12 noon here on Local Public Radio. Up next here at 11 o'clock, it will be Reveal. This is 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco. All of what you hear here is made possible by listeners and supporters all around the Bay Area, like Daniel Murphy of San Francisco, Barbara and Thomas Metcalf of Kensington, and Lori Chiron of Davis, a new member. 11 o'clock is the time, KALW, San Francisco.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letton. Today on the show... You know there's more to this story.
Everybody, I just finished teaching the Art of Yen course. I teach traders all over the world how to trade the Japanese yen.
masters of the art of the con.
We know what it takes to dominate this financial market, and we can teach you to do just the same.
I said to myself, I'm not gifted at this area. If this guy is doing it, that's all he does all day long. Let me put the money with him. Let him do that.
Also, a woman says she was abused and shunned by her faith.
Because I had been told, don't speak of this. It's a confidential matter. The congregation doesn't need to know this.
And she was left behind by her family.
Even when I was speaking on the stand, I looked out and my mother and dad wouldn't look at me.
These stories and more on this hour of Reveal. But first, this news.